Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. You're tuning to the SFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at the latest from the team at Famous Brands. They have announced that they would be expanding into Malaysia. We're going to speak to them and get a sense of what that is about. We also have a conversation with the Chief Executive Officer at Signia Asset Management, Magda Virzuska. She joins us to take a look at her views around the venture capital markets in South Africa and how we could bolster those efforts. Then we have a conversation with the team at Glencore taking a look at the latest memorandum of understanding that has been entered into between South African smelters and Eskom around tariffs and potentially reducing the impact of those tariffs. We also have a conversation with the team at Adams & Adams taking a look at the platform that they have developed to help businesses better deal with the AI or artificial intelligence risks that they are confronted with. And then because it's Tuesday, we're going to wrap up the show with a property conversation. We're going to be taking a look at South Africa's housing market and what we make of it for 2025.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We kick off the show, as always, with a sense of market movements throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunz, to take a look at market movements and try and make sense of them. Nick, always lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. The silver price, all-time highs, $60 a fine ounce. I suppose that's a good place to start because we've never been here before, but it does bring back that all-important gold-silver ratio into focus, and it seems we're finally starting to see that differential narrowing. What do you make of that?
Yeah, evening, Jimmy. I always chuckle when you say trying to make sense of it. He's joining us, yes. So let's try and make sense of the silver price. Silver's such an interesting topic because it's normally, yeah, it's highly speculative. It's normally not in everyone's sort of radar. It's not something you typically invest with. And to be honest, for South Africans, not that easy to get access to get silver, but starting to get more and more sort of recognition. Now, you mentioned the gold silver ratio. That is a ratio that typically says if silver should be catching up or not with gold, and it has been signifying it as undervalued. So you're seeing it run up, but goodness me, it's had a strong, I mean, the silver price now over 100% up since January the 1st.
Nick, that's not the only market that's over 100% up since January. Mm-hmm. If we're looking at commodities, by and large, they were all pretty much performing in that kind of range and in that breadth. What do you make of kind of where we sit at this point in the year? We haven't yet seen, I suppose, the beginning of the Santa rally or the Christmas rally that we're so used to. But in the context of how hard markets have run, perhaps it would be a bit selfish to want to see that at this stage.
Oh, possibly. I mean, I was putting together a PowerPoint yesterday just on sort of looking back on the year. And, you know, the thing that stood out for me sort of most of all, Jimmy, was how much everything has run. I mean, you call it the everything rally. I mean, Spain up, you know, 40-odd%. The Italian market's up over 20%. Our market's up over 30%. And you mentioned the commodities. I mean, you know, also such strong runs. The only one that hasn't run, I guess, is, which I would have never put this in my sort of list for January, was cryptos, Bitcoin. You know, that's actually down on the year, first year down, I don't know how long. And, of course, the dollar. Worst performance in the dollar for good about 50 years. I think late 1970s, last time we saw the Dixie this week. So overall, can we expect it to continue? I don't see why not. Obviously, the Fed tonight in a few hours' time, we are expecting an interest rate cut in America by the Fed tonight. That might add a little bit more fuel to the fire. So we might very well get that infamous Santa Claus rally for the next 2 weeks.
Nick, you bring the performance of the dollar up, and I want to look at that. Obviously, a lot of that having to do with the Oval Office, the current president and his administration, and the events of April 4th in Liberation Day. Let's take a look at perhaps your crystal ball going into 2026. We've seen pretty much what markets would imagine is the worst of what could possibly be coming out of the United States. But I suppose coming into 2025, we didn't know that we could have ended up where we are today. Is there any realm of possibility where the dollar goes into 2026 weaker and continues to weaken?
Sure. So, I mean, from a short-term perspective, let's look from that trading sort of view. You know, the dollar looks like it's a little bit overdone on the downside. So if you look at the technicals, it's, as I said earlier, you know, it's had its worst run in 50-odd years. Can you get another year of dollar weakness? Probably, I would imagine, maybe a little bounce coming at some point. And also the Fed tonight. You know, if the Fed come out with a statement that they're a little bit, a hawkish cut, as the saying goes, we could very well get a bit of a dollar strength. But I think long-term, difficult to argue against a weaker dollar. You know, you're seeing more and more countries pivoting away for dollar settlement. You're seeing, as you mentioned, all the shenanigans coming out of the Oval Office, that flip-flopping Trump administration. You know, it makes people nervous about being in dollar-denominated assets. And then also, what's been driving the market this year with AI and those Magnificent Seven shares, you know, those valuations are starting to look very stretched. At some point, valuations do matter. And I think you'll start seeing a bit of a pivot maybe out of the dollar. So I think longer term, it's very difficult to find a positive for the dollar, other than that it does, I guess, remain the world's currency of choice for the time being.
Nick, what do you make of the rest of the year? We, as you mentioned, have that interest rate decision, which will likely be the last big economic conversation or economic indicator that we get out of markets for the time being. Markets seemingly kind of winding down. We have very few trading days left of the year. What do you make of just where we are today? And I mean, the Rand sitting just above 17 Rand, been fighting with that 17 Rand level. Are we closing out the year in a good space?
I think from a South African point of view, domestically, I'd say yes. You know, it's so easy. We've said it a few times when we've chatted. It's so easy to bash the South African story endlessly, you know. But, I mean, you need to give credit when credit's due. I think the Reserve Bank, Mr. Koniagi and his team, yes, we'd like interest rates a lot lower. So early Christmas presents, please, if possible. But, they run a very tight ship. They're well-respected. There's a reason the Rand is where it is. It's not just the government's policies. It's also a very, very credible independent central bank we have. So credit there as well. And look at some of the rhetoric that's coming out from the ratings agency. Have given us a positive outlook, S&P's. We got off the grey listing. We've got a lot of the local SA Inc. companies are starting to look pretty decent as well. A little bit of M&A activity coming. So, I mean, there's so much, Jimmy, that we can actually look at from an SA local perspective and look at the barometer to the country, which is the currency. I mean, sitting around about 17. So looking pretty good. And we don't even mention the bonds. I mean, the bonds are trading with a yield on our 10-year of like 8.4%. That's unheard of. I mean, they went out to 13%. So the last couple of years, that's a 50% move on our bonds. And that's the real money. That's telling you where things are. Those are the pension funds. Those are the overseas investors who are putting money in our bond markets. Yes, there is a differential yield between us and the rest of, say, the first world. But don't take it away from a good work that's been done. And I think going into next year, I wouldn't be surprised to see that sort of tailwind of positivity continuing. There we go. Early Christmas present.
Nick, is there anything that concerns you going into next year that you perhaps might want to keep an eye on or that you might want to stay away from for the time being? I know there's very little in a market that has run as hot as it has, but are there any areas where, like the crypto market that you touched on earlier, you might be thinking, hey, you guys haven't had the best year and perhaps next year might not be that much better?
Yeah, look, forecasting cryptos, I haven't a clue. I don't think anyone does.
I don't think anyone does.
And I don't want to get into this conversation either bullish or bearish on cryptos. I think things that do concern me, though, is the concentration risk in America with AI shares, hyperscalers, the amount of money that's been thrown around. I can't even make sense of it. I mean, $100 billion here, $200 billion there. I honestly can't even keep track of the amount of money that's been spent. And at some point, you've got to take stock as a shareholder and say, you know, are they going to return on all of this, and that's what concerns me. Is at some point, you know, that does sort of maybe that, and it is a bubble over there in some of those shares. That bubble does deflate a bit. That is globally, it's going to knock everything, unfortunately. So that is a little bit of a concern there. And then also, you know, there's a concern as well that some parts of the world are starting to slow down. The numbers that are coming out of China are not great. You do expect the government to do something, but they certainly aren't encouraging. And also the reason the Fed might cut tonight, despite, you know, stubborn inflation, is the US economy also slowing down a bit. So you've got the number one economy in the world and the number two economy in the world that are sort of struggling. So that might be the little bit of caution that dampers a few things going into next year. But I think places like Europe and the emerging markets are in quite a good space. Emerging market balance sheets are better than they've ever been with how strong the commodities have run as well. So that's the positive, but the negative is, you know, I think there is a few risks around the corner you've got to be cautious of.
Certainly a good time to be an emerging market like South Africa. We have been finding a lot of favor in the international and local investment spaces. We'll see if that continues going into 2026. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Nick for the time and for the contributions as always. Portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunz, joining me on markets to reflect on what's been moving them and perhaps what could move them in the near future.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
South African pension funds should invest at least 0.5% of their monies into venture capital initiatives. That is the view of the CEO of Signia Asset Management, Magda Virziska. And for those that don't know who Signia Asset Management is at this point, they are one of the largest asset managers in South Africa that are currently the custodians of north of 400 billion rands in South African assets. We're going to take a look at this in a bit more detail with the company's CEO and see if we can make sense of this. I'm joined on the line now by Magda to take a look at these developments and see what we make of them. Auntie M, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. This is certainly one way to get venture capital investment increased in South Africa. What sparked this view?
Well, you know, I have spent the last 7 years with one foot in South Africa, one foot in the UK. And the business I set up in the UK was is a venture capital business. So I've been quite involved in this field of seeding and providing capital to founders of businesses, to entrepreneurs, new entrepreneurs. And, you know, what you see is in that kind of tier is that if you deploy enough capital into building up businesses, those businesses, the successful ones, become the job creators, become the disruptors, become the innovators, and provide this foundation to the growth of an economy. And this is, of course, what we are sadly lacking in South Africa. And, you know, it is sad to say that we have virtually no venture capital market in South Africa, i.e. no support and no capital support for founders of businesses. And, you know, I can speak from experience because 20 years ago, I was one of those founders and with no capital behind me and how difficult it was to build up a business. So my view is, you know, we should be making it simpler. And then where is the largest pool of capital that we could access? You know, clearly it's South African pension funds. And I am not talking about, you know, everyone talks about ESG investing. Well, how about investing back in South Africa? And I'm not talking about some huge, significant percentage of assets, not 0.5%. It really is insignificant, but could make enormous difference to the economy. So, you know, to me, it's a very simple equation, and I can even tell you how to achieve it.
Auntie M, this is a conversation you and I have definitely had in our private conversations around the state of venture capital in the South African landscape and what needs to be done to spur that on. You touched on the fact that this could potentially be a good catalyst for job creation, for economic growth. Can we take a look at how the introduction of new ventures and new businesses then starts to reshape how we see investable assets in South Africa?
100%. I mean, let's look at, and this is where I start, let's look at two things. Let's look at our young demographics. So, yes, there are lots of unemployed people. But we've got very young demographics. And, you know, entrepreneurs of businesses are usually, and innovators are usually young people. It's not people in their 60s. So we've got this, you know, huge layer of young, innovative, ambitious people. You know, we also have, despite everything, we've got some of the leading universities in the world. And we don't need to be number one and compete with Harvard or Oxford. We have very, very good universities in the country. Pretoria, Stellenbosch, you know, UCT, Wits. And within those universities, you have IP being developed, which can then be commercialized by virtue of being taken out of universities, companies being built around that IP. So, you know, we have two things going for us. Ambition, innovation, education, young demographics. So why not? I mean, given the situation that South Africa is in with, you know, as we know, lack of job creation, lack of economic growth, we need to look at innovative solutions for building that economic foundation. And I can't think of anything simpler than supporting those innovative businesses going forward with some capital. And again, I'm not talking about a lot that pension funds would have to allocate.
Now, Auntie M, you mentioned that you have a practical way to get this done and to get this off the ground. What would that entail, and how would we go about doing that if we are to start this conversation?
So, you know, it comes from two sides. Obviously, you have to have experienced people running venture capital funds, and you don't need a lot of venture capital funds. So that's one thing. And they do not have to be big teams of people, you know, and highly costly structures. But more importantly, how do you get capital into those funds? Very simply, you know, retirement funds in South Africa are already governed by Regulation 28, which basically means, you know, you've got restrictions on how much assets you can invest in equity, 75%, offshore, 45%. And that regulation is kind of imposed on retirement funds by National Treasury and FSCA. And that regulation talks to limits, maximum limits, and what you can't do rather than what you should do. So how simple would it be? And, you know, I hate to use the word prescription, so I'm going to use another word just now. How difficult would it be for National Treasury and FSCA to amend Regulation 28 to compel, but again, I'm going to amend that word just now, to compel retirement funds in South Africa to invest 0.5% in venture. But let me change that word from prescription, because everyone, you know, immediately sits up and goes prescription. You know, in the UK, because I've now had a lot of experience in venture in the UK, what the government did is they called in the largest pension funds in UK and got them to sign a commitment agreement where they committed to deploying 5% of the assets into UK innovation by 2030. So it is a compact rather than a prescription. And imagine the largest pension funds in South Africa doing exactly the same. And incidentally, those pension funds are all pension funds associated with SOEs, such as Eskom and Transnet. So how difficult would it be for National Treasury and FSCA to call the boards of trustees of those funds and say, guys, sign this pledge, which commits you to investing in, and, you know, let's forget 5 years. It's too long. I hate 5 years. You know, I'll be 61 by that stage, really. Let's commit to deploy that capital in the next 2 to 3 years into credible venture capital funds, which can support credible innovation in South Africa. It's a meeting and 2 weeks to change some paperwork and another month to call all the boards of trustees together. We could be done in, you know, by Q1 2026, we could be there.
From someone who has walked this journey and built a business over the last 20 years and done it practically in South Africa, a strong message on how collaboration and just rethinking how we approach things could solve a lot of our problems. I think this is the perfect note to leave the conversation on. Thank you so much, Auntie M, for those insights and for the time. Magda Wierzyska, the founder and CEO of Signia Asset Management, joining us to take a look at how we could transform asset management and venture capital in South Africa.
On the farm, every season brings challenges. Will the rain come? Will the soil deliver enough? But I'm not facing those challenges alone. With Omnia by my side, I receive more than fertilizer. I have access to science, innovative solutions, and people who care about my success.
At Omnia, your best harvest is our greatest achievement. Together we grow more than crops, we grow futures. Contact Omnia today and start growing your future.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Famous Brands today announced that they will be expanding into Malaysia with the first of their master license agreements that's been concluded. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the managing executive of four quick service restaurants at Famous Brands, Terry Boardman. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Terry, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for the time. Interesting decision to go into the Malaysian markets. Famous Brands has got quite the footprint in South Africa already and in other regions. Why Malaysia?
Yeah, so I think, Jimmy, thanks for having me on the show, and good evening to your listeners as well. I think it's important to understand that we're quite selective about the markets that we go into, and in the case of Malaysia, it was really around linking up with a great partner in the market. That was a kind of key decision. And having a look at the market, there's lots of similarities in terms of how the market behaves, specifically in terms of the consumer looking for great value. There's a high propensity in the market to go out and frequent takeaways and kind of get out for a meal. So, you know, high opportunity within the market, and lots of similarities in terms of our experiences across Africa with, you know, very strong family units and a very kind of transient type market that kind of moves between Kuala Lumpur and out into the villages, etc., within Malaysia. So, yeah, some similarities and obviously a nice opportunity with the Mesra group, and that's why the decision was made to enter the market after quite a bit of research and in-market interactions with the Mesra Group.
Terry, let's take a look at the strategic rollout of the expansion into Malaysia. I mean, from a Famous Brands perspective, there is no shortage, rather, of good portfolio assets, leading brands, signature brands, the quick service restaurants. Why go in with this specific restaurant or these specific restaurants as a start, understanding how vast your portfolio is? Is it because of the demand in the Malaysian market that you're seeing, or is it because these could potentially be your best performing portfolio assets to go into that market with?
Jimmy, I think it's twofold. If you look at the market, obviously burger consumption with the market is very strong. So there's great consumer demand on the burger side. So obviously going in with Steers was a natural progression. Debonair's pizza as well, if you look at the pizza consumption in the market, is probably potential for growth. So we see that as an opportunity to kind of grow the pizza consumption by taking a very different types of pizza experience and pizza offering into the Malaysian market. From that perspective, I mean, if you look, I mean, essentially it sits around burger, chicken, and pizza in terms of the three biggest categories worldwide. So, I mean, Steers and Debonair's big brands in South Africa are doing well within the African markets and obviously has the potential to kind of grow there. Another key factor is because Mesra is obviously linked to the Petronas Group with petroleum sites across the country. I mean, we have good experience and good expertise in terms of rolling out with petroleum partners. And on that basis, they've got the real estate to kind of facilitate putting in Steers and Debonair's pizzas across those type of environments and enhancing their retail offering in those C-store environments. So, yeah, a nice opportunity, and I think a nice strategic alignment and link to their needs as well as ours.
Terry, let's take a look at menu options. We've seen many QSR rollouts across borders, kind of customizing menus to that particular region or to that particular location. Is that something that Famous Brands is going to be looking to do in the Malaysian markets or perhaps in other markets as well outside the South African markets? A lot of the Famous Brands are specifically South African brands, and they bring a unique sense of flavor to international markets. But we have seen with some of your competitors as well that they go into a new market and they bring in a menu that's more localized in that respect. How is Famous Brands seeing that and perhaps your approach in that respect?
Yeah, I mean, we go into the market unapologetic around the fact that we are a South African brand and we've got a very specific differentiation in terms of taste and product. There is some localization around starches, as an example. I mean, the Asian market has a requirement for rice as a starch option, which is not something that is prevalent in our current menu offering. So there has been some adaptations, but the Mesra team in country run Mesra Cafe. They have a very clear understanding of the local market. They've tasted all the products. We've obviously taste tested it with consumers. There's a good buy into what the offer is and the fact that it is differentiated, but there is going to always be some localization and adaption over time. But I mean, we're going in with our best foot forward in terms of our best products and kind of what differentiates us compared to some of the other competitors that are existing in the market.
Terry, before I let you go, I want to take a look at the relationship with Mesra and the master licensing agreement. I mean, Famous Brands, you touched on the fact that we are uniquely South African as a brand, holding over 3,000 restaurants, could quite easily go into this market without a partner and without the need for these sorts of arrangements that you've entered into with Mesra. Where's the strategic advantage from a Famous Brands perspective, other than perhaps the partnerships along the Patronus filling stations and that? How does Famous Brands kind of approach your licensing agreements, understanding that you are big enough to not need them?
You know, I think at the end of the day, we are a great franchising business. I mean, that's predominantly, and on that essence, we have the systems, we've got the know-how, we've got great brands. At the end of the day, you know, partnerships are strengthened when there is someone that has a local understanding of the market. And importantly here, I mean, supply chain is obviously key in the market, and Mesra will be developing both warehousing and supply chain to supply into Steers and Debonair's Pizza within the market. And that's a key component in terms of developing consistency of product, getting pricing right so that we can obviously deliver on the front end in terms of a great value and experience for the Malaysian consumer. So I think like anything, you could always do things on your own. But when you find the right partner and they have a local understanding and they've got the current capability and capacity and know-how in their market, that can only strengthen the potential and the opportunity that exists in that market.
Terry, do you get a bit more confidence from the state of the economies that you are looking at? So the Malaysian economy, as an example, is a fast-growing economy at the moment that is doing GDP growth north of 4%. Do you, as a brand, as Famous Brands, get a bit more comfort in being able to expand into markets that are already fast-growing or fast-moving? And does that make rollout easier?
I think, Jimmy, absolutely. I mean, we all know it's tough to do business in Africa. There's no doubt around that. I mean, disposable income has been a challenge, as we know, on home ground. When you look at a country that's got 34 million people plus, it's got less than a 3% unemployment rate, it's got a fast-growing economy, and it's got some of the fundamentals that I think probably make it attractive in terms of growth potential. And we're aligned with getting some great real estate through this partnership with the Mesra Group and getting access to that and growing the brands in like really great locations. That for us is quite important. But I think at the end of the day, it's a great market. It's got, it feels a little bit like, kind of South Africa and the African continent from time to time, just in terms of how the consumer behaves in the market. But I must also note that when you have a look in terms of the frequency of kind of the out of home eat out occasion for the Malaysian consumer, it's off the charts, and they really do like going out and kind of enjoying life from a takeout perspective and getting out and about. So the frequency is great. So yeah, all I think all the fundamentals are there for a great opportunity. And what we got to do is get out of the market, put our best foot forward, deliver great product and a great experience. And you know, as they say, you grow a brand, one pizza at a time, one burger at a time, and importantly, one suburb and one community at a time. So, you know, that's the job to be done. But the opportunity is certainly there in the Malaysian market.
Opportunities are plenty in Malaysia for the team at Famous Brands, and that is why they've elected to go into that market at this particular time. All the best to the Famous Brands team. Let us know how this goes, but for now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the managing executive for Quick Service Restaurants, Terry Boardman, joining us to take a look at Famous Brands' expansion into Malaysia.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Eskom has entered into a memorandum of understanding with the Samancor Chrome as well as Glencore Merafe Chrome Ventures to potentially save the South African ferrochrome smelter sector and save thousands of jobs. We're going to be taking a look at this and seeing how this could potentially impact those jobs and that sector. I'm joined on the line by the CEO of Glencore Ferroalloys, Yapi Fulod, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Yapi, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with an overview of the smelting space. I mean, for Samancor, for Glencore Merafe, both businesses operate quite a significant proportion of the market in terms of smelters. Give us a sense of what that looks like from an operational standpoint and why an agreement like this is going to be important for that.
Good afternoon, and also thanks for the opportunity to just give you a bit of insight. I think it is important to just quickly pause and just look at ferrochrome smelting in South Africa. I mean, if you have a look at a couple of years ago, as far back as 2003, we were the biggest ferrochrome producer in the world. And unfortunately, as time went on, and two main reasons, electricity supply, also electricity reliability, did not stay up with the ferrochrome demand. I think you also know that ferrochrome has been used to make stainless steel. And seeing that China have just erupted in terms of stainless steel demand, the ferrochrome demand also grew with it. Like I said, obviously South Africa didn't keep up with that same trend. And as also the UG2 or the PGA miners started to produce, chromite becomes a byproduct. Well, you know, it is a byproduct, and you know, for that reason, more and more chrome ore became available, either in the form of underground ore or primary ore or UG2s as well. So because we couldn't stay up, the Chinese then started to build their own ferrochrome plants, obviously in China, Inner Mongolia, and they surpassed us as the leading ferrochrome producer in, I would say, around 2012. And from there, they just kept on growing, and we as South Africa started to actually be under a massive amount of pressure, if that makes sense.
Yapi, let's take a look at the arrangement and the reason why this is so important? I mean, as it stands, both smelters, both Samancor and Glencore, operate under negotiated price agreements with NERSA, with Eskom that have been approved by NERSA. But I think let's perhaps explain for the listeners the context upon which smelters and the electricity input factors into from a cost aspect. I mean, at least 30 to 40% was the last estimates as to the electricity line item on its own. Take us through the impact of that line item on your operations and your costs.
Yeah, I must say, I think that you summarized that quite well in terms of the challenge that we face. So if you have a look at what happened with electricity, so when we as Glencore Morafe built the last ferrochrome smelter in South Africa, it was about 2006. We built two furnaces, and then 2013 another two. And that was the Lion Complex that's in Steelpoort, one of the biggest complexes in the world. It was the cheapest ferrochrome producer in the world as well, by the way. And it was because we had cheap electricity. So one of the biggest challenges is that since 2007, 2008, electricity has grown more than 900% accumulative, where inflation, let's say, grew with 103. So obviously you can now see that there's a massive difference between inflation versus the ferrochrome or, you know, electricity. And for that reason, and 100% corrected or, you know, correct in saying that cost in terms of beneficiation, because we are energy intensive users, and for that reason, because of that spike, it actually made us uncompetitive towards a place like China. If that, you know, I mean, that's, you know, in short, the, you know, the biggest reason why some of our businesses do not operate. I can also say that 0 out of 22 of our furnaces currently running, and I know Samancor, maybe they've got 4 out of 24, something like that, running.
Yeah, but before I let you go, I want to take a look at the strategic advantage to being able to resolve this and to be able to getting our smelters and our ferrochrome market back to where it was. I mean, South Africa from a production point of view is still probably one of the leading chrome producers in the world, possibly even one of the leading ferrochrome producers in the world. Let's go through the strategic benefits of just making sure that the Section 189s are resolved, the sector gets back on track, and we can use this sector to actually grow the economy and to position South Africa globally.
Yeah, I think if you have a look at ferrochrome production in South Africa, if you take chrome ore and you just mine the ore, and you export the ore to China, if you have a look at the finance, you then convert this into ferrochrome. And remember, we use anthracite, we use reductants, we use steel, we use a lot of additional elements into our product. And for that reason, the financial benefit to South Africa is 5 times more than just normal ore. So you can just imagine what that means for you know, the GDP of the country. That's the first thing. The second thing is, obviously, if we can get this right, and I can tell you honestly, Eskom and the government are really working hard with us to try to find a solution. And we believe that we can get solutions. And if you have a look at the amount of people that we were going to put, you know, out of jobs, were far above the 2000 mark. So, but now if we can suspend or extend the Section 189, and we can save those jobs, then the labor multiplier is 8 times. So for every one job that you save about 4, 8 indirect jobs. So you can just imagine what impact that has on the people and also on the local community.
A sector that has the potential to contribute immensely to the South African economy and to the jobs in the South African economy. Hopefully we can get this memorandum of understanding into more than that and save all of these jobs and save the sector. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much for those insights and for the time. Chief Executive Officer at Glencore Ferroalloys, Yapi Fulod, joining us to take a look at Eskom's latest agreement with South African ferrochrome smelters and what that could potentially do.
The festive rush doesn't wait. Orders, deliveries, messages, calls. This summer, you'll need connectivity that doesn't tap out when the pressure is on. With Telkom Business, you get reliable, high-speed connectivity for just $2.99 per month. That's our unlimited LTE, all-hours basic plan, 10 megabytes per second. No caps, no excuses.
This summer, your business deserves the best. Visit telkom.co.za/business for deals that grow your business. T's and C's apply. Telkom Business. Possible begins here.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Whilst artificial intelligence has taken over the investing side of markets, a lot of investment companies focusing on AI, investing in AI, smaller businesses have been exposed to a lot of AI-related risks. It's opened up a world that small businesses and even bigger businesses might not be prepared for. We're going to be taking a look at this and how to better prepare businesses for artificial intelligence with the lead partner for artificial intelligence and intellectual property advisory at Adams & Adams, Darren Olifiori. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of their latest smart AI portal. Darren, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about the portal design. I mean, Adams & Adams is a law firm that is well known in the intellectual property space. Why come up with this portal? What is it for?
Thanks, Jimmy. Thanks for having me on the show. Look, the idea is that we have been inundated with just queries around artificial intelligence and how it gets regulated. Everything from, you know, you putting in your inputs, your prompts, and getting your outputs, how do you get that protected? How do you prevent confidentiality and trade secrets being, you know, leaked out of your organization? And all those and all the other aspects around it, around the ethics of it, the transparency, the governance of it. And so what we decided to do is just really put together a portal, a kind of self-help portal, really, with, you know, frequently asked questions, so that businesses, small businesses, medium, large businesses can use it, can interact with it. It's like a brochure, but just richer. And, you know, from there, make your own decisions. So, you know, obviously, we can help, you know, there's an opportunity to have a chat with us, but there's also an opportunity just to go on there, and we're finding there's a need for a place with all the resources. So that's what the idea is around the portal, is to put them in one place so that people can access them easily and take it from there.
Darren, these resources that you're looking to put into the portal, take us through just some of the strategic advantages that they would have for businesses. I know they would cover a wide array of AI-related information, but perhaps take us through just some of the important things that businesses can find on this portal, and perhaps whether or not businesses can engage with this in their own spaces, or does it have to be kind of coming through the traditional reaching out to Adams & Adams and collaborating with the law firm? Is this a portal that's easily accessible?
Yeah, no, so it is. So that's how it's designed. So the idea is that we've identified, like, this, let's say, six different types of services, let's say, or needs, let's put it this way. One is policy and vetting. Two is agreements, you know. Three is, you know, asset management. I'm talking about your intellectual asset management. Four is really about just education, you know, and workshops and self-help portals. So what we've done is we've separated the six different areas, and then we have a readiness test. So you can go on in your own time, complete the readiness test, and it works like your Garmin, you know, your Garmin sleep score. You know, you're getting 90 or you're getting 60. Okay, you need to go to bed earlier, you need to turn off the lights, you need to maybe drink less, or whatever it might be. And it gives kind of guidance. Okay, you need maybe workshops internally, or you need policy or your vetting. So you can then determine and on your own where you rank relative to what we call an AI readiness kind of test. And that's unique to yourself. So you can go on, fill it in, do it. You can come chat to us, or you can then say, okay, I need some workshops, or I need online, or I need whatever it might be, and then resource that yourselves, or we're going to try and build services around that that allow a business, from whether they're small or too large, to engage and
as time goes by, just increase their readiness score. So what we're seeing is that these things are driven largely by overseas developments. So what's happening in Europe and what's happening in the States. So we'll monitor that and try and filter it into an African context and provide it something that's practical, because it's so overwhelming that we try to make it simple so that businesses can become compliant, or at least take away the anxiety of not knowing where their risk lies, and use it in that way. So that's the idea.
Quite an interesting way to approach artificial intelligence and the protection of businesses. We'll see how this service and this portal continues to help and aid businesses in their needs as we continue to develop in the artificial intelligence world that we live in today. We'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the lead partner for AI IP Advisory at Adams & Adams, Darren Olifield, for joining us to take us through their new smart AI portal and how it's aimed at assisting businesses ready themselves for artificial intelligence.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't, because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And it's Property Tuesday. We are reflecting on the performance of the housing market in South Africa over the 2025 year. It is an apt time to look back on how markets and other factors have influenced property decisions over the last year. And I'm joined on the line by the Chief Executive Officer at PAM Golding Property Group, Dr. Andrew Golding, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Dr. Golding, always lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Certainly an interesting year from a property perspective, a lot affecting property markets, everything from grey listings to credit rating upgrades to inflation in the market. How has the property market fared, in your opinion, over the year?
Hello, Jimmy. Thanks for having me on the show. So I think, as always in the property market, it's been an interesting year. It started, I think, with some levels of pessimism and concern. But as the year has gone on, off the back of interest rate reductions and the very good news around the grey list, I think a strong lending appetite from the banks, and hopefully more interest rate decreases to come in the next year, it's actually ended off pretty well. So I think, all things considered, we'll take this year and bank it.
Dr. Golding, when we look at the performance of the property market, can we kind of identify whether some elements of the market have performed better than others? I'm thinking about comparing everything from coastal properties to non-coastal properties, or looking at sectional titles versus freestanding properties. Are there kind of areas or trends that we've been able to identify throughout the year that might give us an indication of which areas in the property space have had the best performance?
Yeah, so I think overall, off the back of those macroeconomic indicators I mentioned, you know, there's unquestionably been an increase in improvement in sentiment, which adds to confidence. And that is kind of the strongest thing that influences our market. Interest rates themselves are very important. And off the back of that, I think we've seen a number of really positive trends. So we've seen house price growth pretty much across the country at an above inflation level for the first time in a long time. And so that has really been encouraging. We've seen the Johannesburg market come back strongly and be characterized almost amazingly by a shortage of stock and the start of what we see as a recovery of that market. We've seen the Cape Town and Western Cape market continue to outperform. We've seen the coastal market, certainly at the top end of the market, really perform strongly, but also the non-coastal areas, when we compare coastal with non-coastal, come back strongly. And then in respect to freehold and sectional titles, I think we've seen a continuation of the trend now that we've seen for quite some time around the increase in appetite for sectional title properties. And then from a provincial point of view, we've also seen a recovery in many of the markets that were slightly in the doldrums relative to others. And also from a metro perspective, we've seen almost every metro, whether it be Tshwane or whether it be Gauteng, even the Limpopo metro market, really recovering strongly together with the coastal markets, which have been performing strongly anyway.
Dr. Golding, what of buyers' confidence? We know that for the longest time, buyers have been waiting for interest rates to come down. We finally got that. We even got a readjustment of our inflation targeting from a South African perspective. What has that done to the optimism from a buyer's perspective? And is that something we can carry into 2026?
Yeah, I think very much so. And as I said earlier, I think we are optimistic that hopefully this interest rate decrease trend is one that's going to continue. There's talk of, as much as perhaps three interest rate decreases of 75 basis points through the course of next year. And there's no doubt that that is the single biggest driver of the housing market. It also feeds into the appetite for the banks to lend and generally create activity in the property market, which leads to buoyancy. So I think there is a cautiously optimistic view of next year off the back of that interest rate and bank lending environment.
Dr. Golding, you touched on the banks, and I want to look at some of the big changes that have been in the works for the longest time. The Central Bank of South Africa has been looking to move from how interest rates are governed at a commercial bank level. We're migrating from what is known as JIBAR to ZARONIA. That's set to have an impact on mortgages. Can we just get a bit of an understanding on what that impact could potentially look like from a mortgage perspective? If someone is looking at their mortgage, we know that there is the potential for recalculating and renegotiating the mortgage now that the basis of the interest is being changed. What does that mean for existing mortgage holders?
Yeah, so I think we are entering into an ever-increasingly competitive mortgage market, more and more players coming into the market, and the ability of the consumer to shop around, hopefully very successfully, in finding the best deal for themselves. There is a vibrant mortgage market in South Africa, lots of competition between the banks, and hopefully increasing levels of rate concession, which matches appetite in terms of the way the banks manage their own mortgage book. So I think all of that augurs well for consumers, and in particular for first-time home buyers, who I think globally are finding it harder and harder to get into the property market, but where the mortgage market is a key component of that.
Dr. Golding, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts around what trends you expect to potentially continue going into the new financial year. Obviously, we don't know what tomorrow holds, but we have been seeing a couple of emerging trends, things like reverse emigration, people moving back away from the coast back towards inland properties. We've seen that rise in international investors coming into the South African market. Do you expect some of these trends to continue into the new year?
Yeah, very much so. I think we are certainly seeing the Johannesburg market, Johannesburg and Pretoria markets come back strongly. And whether that's a reverse immigration trend or just an acknowledgement that those are two of the powerhouses of the country economically, I think that's likely to continue. We've certainly seen off the back of global uncertainty that foreigners are taking a view on South Africa and investment into the South African property market. And I think we're going to continue to see that. And off the back of that, I think we're going to continue to see the luxury market in South Africa continue to be buoyant as international and local investors take a view on what we have at the top end of our luxury markets and relative to other places in the world. I think we still compare incredibly favorably. And so that appetite, that demand versus the supply, I think we're still going to see. So I think all in all, optimistic trends for and positive trends for the next 12 months of next year.
The South African property market remains an attractive investment option, and we're seeing an increase in buying power and buying trends. Hopefully that continues into the 2026 financial year and calendar year. We'll leave the conversation on that note for now. Thank you so much to the Chief Executive Officer of the PAM Golding Group, Dr. Andrew Golding, for joining us to share his insights on the performance of the property market over the last year and what we can make of it.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
And that's the show for today, folks. It's coming up to 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.